Well, we're doing a little time traveling tonight on Coast to Coast as we go back during the Kennedy-Nixon era to talk about things that you may have heard a little bit of, but we're digging deep into it with Roger Stone, Nixon's Secrets, next on Coast to Coast AM. Nixon knew Ruby. I'm going to keep saying that. We'll get to that. So, Roger, we wanted to use Eisenhower, I guess, in the campaign for Nixon, but Mamie says, no, he's too sickly. He can't handle it. What happens then?
Well, Eisenhower insists on doing something. So he does a late tour of New York, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. And unlike Eisenhower, he really takes the gloves off. He calls Kennedy Little Boy Blue and says, what makes you think he has the experience and the knowledge to be president? Really hits him hard. Eisenhower is immensely popular at the end of his term. So it aids Nixon in closing fast.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon wins after all these screw-ups. Nixon pledges because he can't decide whether to ride in the North or the South. You see, Nixon and Kennedy and Johnson have got this great scam going. Kennedy tours the Midwest, the Far West, in the Northeast, talking about civil rights. And Lyndon Johnson travels the South saying, Jack's only kidding about that stuff. Don't be worrying about the niggers. To the courthouse crowd, he's holding all the old white Southern racist governors together for Jack Kennedy, telling him that JFK is not serious. By the way, when he gets into the Senate, Kennedy's civil rights record, not very good. No Voting Rights Act, the Public Accommodations Act. He demurs because of the old bulls in the Senate are all segregationist Democrats. He doesn't want to clash with them. It's Richard Nixon who desegregates the American schools. It's not Kennedy. It's not LBJ. And that gets lost in the ashes of Watergate.
Amazing. Okay, so Kennedy wins the election. So we know what happens there.
So Kennedy wins the election, and Nixon, still has really nurses the idea that he's been cheated. He looks at contesting it, and he decides not to. There's no question he did consider it. And recently, Paul Rosenberg wrote on Salon that Eisenhower talked Nixon out of it. I think in the end that there are two versions, but I think the bottom line of it, Nixon made a shrewd judgment. There was no recount law in Texas. There was a recount law in Chicago. There wasn't a prosecutor named Wexler assigned to look into the theft by the Daily Machine, and he came up with the goods. But even if you could change Illinois, now what have you achieved if you can't change Texas? And Texas has no recount law.
Right.
Those ballots, they're burned.
And you needed Texas.
You needed Texas. So he decides that he'll just go down as a sore loser and still end up in the same place without the presidency. He decides to retool initially for 64. But you asked the best question early. Why is he in Dallas on November 26, 1963? I think that has to be examined for
mm-hmm.
a moment. By 1962, he loses the governorship. 63, he is not a power player. He's a former vice president practicing law in a sleepy Wall Street firm still nursing presidential ambitions. So he is hired by the Pepsi-Cola company, Don Kendall, as an attorney. And he is coming to Dallas to speak to a bottlers convention for Pepsi-Cola.
Uh-huh.
But while he's in town, he also holds a press conference, and interestingly enough, he predicts that JFK will dump LBJ from the ticket.
Because he's aware of some improprieties that are going on, right?
He knows Johnson's become a drag, and Bobby has already, Nixon had very good antennae. He is listening to the political gossip. Bobby's already out telling people, don't worry about Lyndon, we're dumping him.
Mm-hmm.
Done. By that, they mean Bobby Kennedy is going to prosecute Lyndon. First of all, we now know, and this is in my updated version, my new updated version of The Man Who Killed Kennedy. It'll be out in paperback. We now know that Drew Pearson, the biggest columnist of the day, had a Sunday column planned for the 24th that would have been in 700 newspapers that said LBJ took a $10,000 bribe from General Dynamics to deliver a defense contract. That's the beginning of the end. Bobby knows that. Justice knows that. They're the ones who gave it to Pearson.
So Bobby, as attorney general, is going to prosecute their vice president.
Right. They're going to basically get him off the ticket and then prosecute him.
Okay, so it doesn't look like they're connected.
Right. But Johnson knows that Life magazine has no fewer than 9 investigative reporters, a veritable SWAT team on the ground in Texas, going through the real estate records. LBJ has enriched himself many times over. Lyndon Johnson didn't sneeze without taking a payoff. Bobby Baker demanded a piece of every contract that came through on defense appropriations. Johnson dealt in cash, huge numbers.
Well, you know, it was what the good old boys did, Rod.
Lyndon Johnson stole over $1 billion in gold. Those numbers were $6 billion today. It's in my updated book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case of LBJ, out in September. It's very well documented. I mean, the guy was the greatest thief that ever had the American president.
So he knew Kennedy had to go.
So he had no choice in the matter. And anyway, Nixon met secretly with LBJ at the Baker Hotel in Dallas, where Nixon was attending meetings. They didn't meet at the Adolphus, where Johnson was staying, and they did not meet at the other hotel where Nixon is later seen. So this is the sequence of events, because many people have asked this. Nixon does go to the home of Clint Murchison, the oil man, but he goes early in the evening for a reception that is in the honor of J. Edgar Hoover. He can't turn Murchison down because in 1962, when he had trouble raising money in the governor's race, Clint was one of the few guys to come through with $200,000, which in 1962 dollars is huge money. So he goes to a reception, and there's a number of very prominent Dallas citizens there. H.L. Hunt is there. Lyndon Johnson is not there. H.L. Hunt is there. John Carrington, his lawyer, is there. Ed Clark, Johnson's right-hand man, I think the man who orchestrated the execution of John Kennedy, is there. It's who's who of the right wing. Congressman Bruce Alger, who's a right-wing Republican, is even there. It's who's who of Dallas society in the right wing. By 10 o'clock, Nixon is seen back in his room, back at his hotel on the roof restaurant, having dinner, not with, but at the same time as Joan Crawford, who is also in town for the Pepsi-Cola Bottlers Convention because she's on the board of Pepsi-Cola.
Aha, okay.
So Nixon is clearly brought to Dallas by Kendall, and he has a private sit down with Johnson, which has not been recorded previously.
And don't you find that strange?
Well, I think that Johnson understood that there was one guy who could put these pieces to figure out what was going on. So he really sets him up. He tells Nixon that he's very concerned about how Dallas is going to receive the president the following day when he arrives. It's a cauldron of hate and right wing and the right wing. And he prevails on Nixon to call Republican Congressman Bruce Alger and tell him to tone it down, because people are calling Kennedy a traitor, a communist.
Oh, yeah. They were
very ugly.
It was a bad situation.
2 weeks previously, Adlai Stevenson, who Joe McCarthy used to refer to as Adlai Stevenson, in a reference to Alger Hiss, Adlai Stevenson, Kennedy's U.N. ambassador, is spat upon and beaten with placards when he's in Dallas 2 weeks prior to the assassination.
And weren't there other two failed assassination attempts on Kennedy in other states?
They certainly looked at it in Miami and Chicago, and I think that's pretty well documented. The other thing that's interesting is that Marina Oswald tells the FBI that her husband talked about killing Nixon, and one day he has his gun in his hand, and he says, "I'm going out. I hear Nixon's in town. I'm going to see, check it out." But Nixon is not in town at that time. That was what was widely reported. Nixon told the FBI that, no, he had no schedule to be in town at that time. Peter Dale Scott, one of the great JFK assassination researchers, learned that that wasn't really the truth, that Nixon had tentatively agreed to a speaking engagement from some right-wing oil men in Texas at that time, but the event had never materialized, and he had changed his plans to come to Dallas instead on November 22nd.
Now, wasn't George H.W. Bush there, too?
George H.W. Bush is in Dallas also, but he forgets it for 30 years. He can't remember where he is when Kennedy is shot.
We all knew where we were when Kennedy was shot.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary lie. Look, there are several things that are true. George H.W. Bush is CIA prior to his becoming director of Central Intelligence. He's working for the agency as early as 1961, raising money from right-wingers on the Bay of Pigs operation. There's just no doubt about it. And we know FBI documents under Hoover's signature direct his agents to brief George Bush of the CIA, and that is the same George Bush, even though the government has attempted to pretend it's not. George Bush has got an alibi. He goes out of his way to have an alibi. He flies from Dallas in the morning to Tyler, Texas. As soon as he gets to Tyler, he calls the FBI agent in Houston says, I just want you to know I'm here in Tyler, right here.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. It's,
here 12, I am.
6 minutes after Kennedy's been shot, I'm here in Tyler.
I'm here.
Just, 6 minutes after Kennedy's executed in Dallas. It's an alibi.
You think he knew what was going on?
They certainly move in the same clique here. I mean, the Bush family is very tight with military intelligence. The Bush's running mate, the Republican running mate, Jack Alston Crichton, for governor, the Republican, is the head of military intelligence in Dallas and very tight with the agency. He's monitoring this whole thing from a bunker.
When did the clock start, Roger, to do Kennedy in?
My guess is that, and this is one of the dirty little secrets, Kennedy was a methamphetamine addict.
Well, that's
Kennedy
because of his back, wasn't it?
Well, I think ostensibly, but he became addicted to meth. I don't know about you, but I don't want the President of the United States, the guy with his finger on the button, to be high.
No, I don't either.
But here's what we know. Just before the 1960 debate, the first famous debate we talked about, the one where they said Jack Kennedy looked like a bronze god, that's what Teddy mm-hmm. White wrote, that he got an injection of methamphetamine in his voice box. That's why he was so confident and glowing. He was high as a kite.
In his voice box?
In his voice box. This is detailed in a terrific book called Dr. Feelgood, but Kennedy was being treated by Dr. Max Jacobson.
Jeez. Now, we know he had a bad back, right?
Well, I don't think Robert Kennedy became very concerned about these injections. Jack was getting them. By the way, Frank Sinatra was getting them. Marlon Brando was getting them.
Methamphetamine injections?
Yeah, Dr. Feelgood was injecting all these people. He was the doctor to the stars.
Oh
he
God.
Would tell them that this was a mixture of hormones and vitamins that'll make you feel good.
He lied to them?
Largely. So Robert Kennedy, then the attorney general, gets the injection, gets a sample from Kennedy, sends it to a government lab and finds out it's methamphetamine, tells his brother. And Jack Kennedy says, I don't care what it is, it makes me feel good.
He's hooked,
and orders that Jackie begin injections.
Jeez.
Kennedy's sexual overdrive, I think, is largely due to the fact that he's hopped up on meth.
Yeah, that could be. That could be.
Because he's taking enormous risks. I mean, he is dallying with 19-year-old interns in the White House while Jackie's out of town. She finds a small pair of panties in the bed.
Oh, God. So, at some point, somebody says, this guy's got to go.
Well, I have no proof of this, but I, of course, have always assumed that the CIA and Johnson and the Defense Combine and the oil boys rationalized their decision to execute Kennedy based on the fact that he's a drug addict. My God, he's going to sell us out to the Russians when he's high. This is how they rationalize his murder.
They thought it was justified.
Well, they think he's bungled they know the truth about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, the mainstream media idea that Jack Kennedy backed the Khrushchev down and is a great hero is a myth. Khrushchev took Kennedy to the cleaners. 40 years later, we learn that we gave up our strategically placed missiles in Turkey and Italy. No one told us that in real time. That was concealed from the American people. The Kennedys made a cynical Boston political deal with Khrushchev, and he was scoffing about it. He took them to the cleaners. But the Central Intelligence Agency knew, the Joint Chiefs knew, the NSC knew, the NSA knew.
So Johnson benefits because he's not going to get indicted.
He stays out of jail. Right. I mean, they're hot on his trail.
Why did he keep it? Bobby was going to go after Johnson and get him indicted. Why did he keep him as attorney general?
He wants to keep him where he can control him. By the way, Jackie and Bobby, they have their own plan. They're trying to talk Johnson into taking Bobby on the ticket. This is why people say, well, if Jacqueline Kennedy knew that Johnson killed her husband, and I believe she did, why was she not so nice to him in these various White House tapes?
That's bizarre.
It's very simple, because she is trying to sweet-talk Johnson into taking Bobby, who, by the way, is by that time her lover.
Wait a minute. You're saying Jackie Kennedy is playing around with Bobby?
Oh, there's no question. They become lovers after the assassination of Jack in their mutual grief. And she's sweet-talking LBJ. LBJ, this guy's outrageous. He calls her up and says, you can hear this tape. He says, honey, I just called to flirt with you Texas style. And you tell little John and Caroline, I want to be their daddy. Now, this is the guy who murdered these children's father. This is what a sick, psychotic sociopath Lyndon Johnson is.
And where was Oswald in all of this? Was he part
Oswald
of,
Oswald is a pawn.
Was he the patsy he says he was?
Yes, he's U.S. intelligence. He's been an informant for the FBI. He's done informant work for the CIA. He's trained in North Carolina.
But he's there.
He's definitely there. He's positioned there to take the fall. The shooter, but, not to reprise the man who killed Kennedy too much here, but there's multiple shooters, but the shooter in the Texas school book depository is Lyndon's shooter, Mac Wallace. Lyndon Johnson's a control freak.
But
he's not leaving this to the mob and the agency by themselves.
But Oswald was in that building.
He was in the building. He's been set up. He is on the second floor when the shooting goes down. He's positioned to take the fall.
And then
he figures it out. That's why he flees. They say, why did he flee? Because he realized he's been set out.
Did he kill Tippit, the cop?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But in any event, so let's go back to Nixon in Dallas. Nixon is completely done by 1963, and the murder of Kennedy has the inadvertent effect of blowing life back into his political career. He is now a viable option. 1964 rolls around. He kind of plays a backstage role trying to set Rockefeller and Goldwater up against each other for epic clash that will turn to him as a compromise. He denies this in his memoirs. He's not telling the truth. He maneuvers quietly for the nomination. He then makes one of his bigger mistakes. At the end, he loses his cool and kind of attacks Goldwater at the Republican Governor's Conference.
He did support Goldwater for a while, didn't he?
Then he flips it. Then he goes to Europe. By the time he comes back, Barry's got it locked up, and Nixon realizes that his previous attack on Goldwater has been self-defeating. Now he's Barry's biggest backer. And, more importantly, he really goes on the stumps. He does more speaking on behalf of Goldwater than Goldwater, who's notoriously lazy and usually drunk, does on his own. Barry was a great guy, but Barry liked to drink, and Barry was uncontrollable
and
irascible.
Johnson used that atomic bomb television spot perfectly.
Well, I know, John. Look, Goldwater was a great man, but he was a cowboy. He was very irascible, very cranky, very hard to get along
so
with.
So tell me how Nixon got to know Jack Ruby. This is bizarre.
Well, this pertains to the assassination. So while Nixon is flying back to New York, Kennedy is killed. Nixon is in the air. When he arrives at Idlewild Airport, they tell him that the president's been shot. He gets into a cab. Now, he tells three different versions of how he learns that the president's been shot. In one version, he says a black woman is standing on a street corner when his cab comes up to a light, and she's crying, and he rolls the window down and says, what happens? And she says, they shot the president. Although, if you think about that story, she must have been more freaked out than he was when she saw who was asking the question.
Who was asking, yeah.
And then he says, when he got alternatively, says when he got to his building on Park Avenue, the doorman says, oh, Mr. Vice President, President Kennedy is dead. He goes upstairs. He calls Edgar Hoover. Hoover takes the call. Nixon says, well, Edgar, I just came back from Dallas. Was it one of those crazy right-wingers? No, Dick, it was a communist. Really? It's been 12 minutes. We already know it's a communist.
He lied to him.
He lied to him. Nixon buys it very briefly until the next day he sees Jack Ruby blow away. Sunday now, blow away Ruby on TV, and he recognizes Ruby. He tells that he is, according to his aide, Nick Rui, who's a major source for my book, he turns white as a sheet, and he says, I know that guy.
Oh, my gosh. And how did he get to know him?
Well, in 1947, it turns out that Lyndon Johnson, Congressman Lyndon Johnson, prevails upon Nixon to get Ruby hired as a paid informant for the House Un-American Activities Committee, and we found the document in House records.
Johnson knew him too.
Yeah, I think he's first of all, Ruby is a mob guy. My guess is that Johnson is carrying water for Carlos Marcello. Ruby is relocating from Chicago to Texas, to Dallas, at the exact time that Nixon is putting him on the payroll. He does it as a courtesy for Lyndon Johnson. He recognizes Ruby as a Johnson guy. Nixon is probably unaware of the fact that this is a favor Johnson is doing for Marcello. Why? Marcello is paying Johnson $5,000 a month, which is huge money in 1960, to cover his illegal gambling operations in Texas.
Hold on, Raj. More to come when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Roger Stone as we talk about Nixon's secrets. Wow, they are secrets. And we'll be back in a moment to continue chatting with him on Coast to Coast Day Out. You know, Roger, I've always said there are no coincidences, and there are way too many possibilities here. Something was up with all of them, I think. All of them.
I don't think there's any question about that. In any event, this Oliver Stone is absolutely right. The death of John Kennedy, combined with the Vietnam War, combined with the murder of Martin Luther King, combined with the murder of Robert Kennedy, clears a path for Nixon to return to power and go to the White House. He becomes president, in essence, on a wave of blood, on a wave of death. But it does set the stage for the greatest single political comeback in American history. Pat Buchanan has a new book out called The Greatest Comeback. It's a very good read, but he gets one thing wrong, and that is when Martin Luther King is murdered in Atlanta, Nixon is running for president, causes huge debate among his advisors as to whether he should go to the funeral. He insists that he must go to the funeral.
I would agree.
He decides that he is going to go to the funeral, but he does not want to march with Bobby and Ethel and and Jackie and Jesse Jackson and Hosea Williams and Daddy King to the cemetery. Does not want to march with
Why
these
not?
People. Well, because he needs Southern white votes. And so he makes a decision to split the difference. He flies to Atlanta. He meets privately and pays his condolences to Coretta King. He's photographed and speaks to the press outside of her house. So he does the right thing. Then he goes to the funeral. He sits with the other dignitaries. He's photographed. But the plan was for him to exit out the side door when others lined up to march behind the caisson, the mule-drawn caisson. Everything was going according to plan, and then suddenly there's a huge black hand on Nixon's shoulder and Wilt Chamberlain turns on Nixon, puts his hand on Nixon's shoulder, Nixon's 5'11", and says, "You ready to march, Mr. Nixon?"
And
Nixon says, "Why, Wilt, absolutely. Well, yes, we'll march." Meanwhile, Nick Rui and Dwight Chapin, Nixon's handlers, are over by the door waving wildly, and Nixon's pretending not to see them. They get into the entourage. And Nixon is marching with Chamberlain. They go about three blocks. Nixon is looking at his watch. The car is following them one block over. They keep trying to single Nixon, who looks like he is ignoring them. Finally, Nixon turns to Wilt Chamberlain and says, "Wilt, in all honesty, I have an airport, a plane waiting to take me to New York." And the stilt says, "Mr. Nixon, do you mind if I catch a ride?" They both bolt for Nixon's waiting car. They fly to New York. By the time they land, Wilt has been hired as a spokesman consultant to the Nixon campaign.
Interesting.
And he goes out and preaches, black capitalism. People forget this. Nixon raised the civil rights enforcement budget as president 800%. The Office of Minority Business Enterprise. The Office of Minority Business Enterprise increased U.S. purchases from black businesses from $9 million to $153 million. Small black business loans to minorities go up 1,000%. U.S. deposits in minority-owned banks, 4,000%.
Look, I'm saying that if he didn't have Watergate on his neck, he would have been considered a great president.
No, there's no question, and that's why I wrote this book, among other things, is to provide some balance. This is not a love letter to Nixon. It's a warts-and-all biography. It's the rise and fall, and final comeback of Richard Nixon. Only because he's able to maneuver the pardon does he come back for his final round as a U.S. statesman and close advisor to William Jefferson Clinton.
He wins in 68. Was that expected?
He wins in 68, and it is charged that he undermined a late bombing haul. I tell a slightly different story. I tell it quite differently. Why does Lyndon Johnson call a dramatic bombing halt 5 days before the election instead of 5 months before the election? He has no concessions from the North Vietnamese. He has no concessions from – he doesn't have the South on board. He's not addressed the question of the NFL and whether they should be at the table. He hasn't got a deal with the Viet Cong. It's a ploy to elect Humphrey, wrapped in national security.
Exactly. I mean, Johnson's already said, "I'm not running," so it's Humphrey all the way.
So Nixon very clearly does. Buchanan denies this, but I think he's incorrect. Nixon does have Senator John Tower and Anna Chenault, who was the gorgeous Asian dragon lady. A widow of General Clear Chenault, the founder of the Flying Tigers and a World War II hero. She was a big Republican. I think she was a lover of Senator John Towers.
And who's Humphrey's running mate? Was Walter Mondale?
His running mate is Ed Muskie.
Ed Muskie,
his
that's
name,
right.
Senator Ed Muskie. So
that's
in any event, they do definitely, and Johnson wiretaps Chenault, learns about this from Hoover. Johnson's wiretapping the Nixon campaign and finds out that they have a back channel to the South Vietnamese. And he is furious because Nixon's on to him. He says it's treason. It's not treason. It's politics.
And brilliant politics.
Well, in the end, the war would not have shortened. Here's the point. The critics say, oh, the war could have ended then. It would have saved 22,000 American lives. That's bull. The war wasn't ending then. We know that Dobrynin writes in his memoirs that he told Johnson at the time, why are you trying, the North Vietnamese will never negotiate the table. Why are you trying to get them to the table? Why are you halting the bombing to get them to the table? It won't work. So it is a ploy. In this case, the grocer's son from Yorba Linda outmaneuvered the wily Texan from the banks of the Pardinales River.
All right, so let's jump ahead. He's elected. Things are, you know, we know what's happening.
Well, this is where things start to go awry because the hawks, the super hawks, think that in Dick Nixon they have their man. They think that he is going to unfetter the military in Vietnam. So when he decides to withdraw us from Vietnam on a really expedited basis and he puts the heat on the Defense Secretary, Mel Laird, to get our troops home over the objections of all of his military advisors.
I mean, Saigon collapses the moment
right.
we leave.
And then he decides that he is going to open the door to China. 1969, he tells Kissinger, I think I'm going to go to China. Kissinger says, you're crazy. You're crazy. Nixon understands that if he can get the Chinese in a dialogue, he can then counter-pressure the Russians for an arms agreement. He
That's
pulls
right.
the whole thing off. He opens the door to China.
All by himself.
He gets an arms control agreement. Why doesn't he destroy the tapes? I'll why. Because he knows that after his death, Kissinger will try to take credit. Well, I was the strategist under Nixon. He was the executor. No, it's the other way around. And Kissinger and Nixon knows that Kissinger is a weasel, who he uses as his leg man.
Well, but he surrounds himself with all these people.
He makes some very, very bad choices. But again, I think it is reaction to the 1960 campaign. He is so outmuscled by the Kennedys, he decides he's going to surround himself with tough guys.
Okay, was Watergate done to get information or done
to pull Nixon down? Well, we're setting the table. So what happens here is that the same people who killed Kennedy, the Joint Chiefs, the agency, the NSC, they are not happy about detente. They are not happy about Vietnam or China or Russia.
They
are spying on Nixon, as we've already discussed. Now I reveal in my book, they try twice to assassinate him.
Nixon?
In 1972, the Frank Sturgis, one of the Watergate burglars,
yeah.
A longtime soldier of fortune and who works for the agency, goes out and recruits an assassin, a gunman named Ed Kaiser. Kaiser has done many dirty deeds for the agency. Kaiser is not told who his target is. First, they talk about using a Vietnam Veterans Against the War protest outside of Nixon's house in Key Biscayne as a cover for launching a small missile at the house to try to kill Nixon. They abandon that plan as unwieldy. Then they decide they're going to shoot him. So Sturgis supplies a gun for Kaiser, and Kaiser is led to believe he's going to kill a pro-Cuban communist. At the last minute, they tell him the target is Nixon, and he says, I don't do political assassinations in the United States. He backs out, and the plot collapses. Scott Kaiser, his son, his important contributor to my book, has his own book coming out, has shared his papers with me. There's no question the agency tries to bump Nixon off. They've spied on him now. They've tried to kill him. And in the end, they sabotage the Watergate break-in. In other words, the guys who drive the break-in are, interestingly, Dean, Magruder, and Liddy. These guys it's a boneheaded plan. But as soon as Liddy recruits Hunt, and as soon as they recruit McCord, the CIA now knows everything. They're both telling their handlers, you're not going to believe what Nixon's guys have planned. They're going to break into the Watergate. John Dean's new book is a fraud. The truth of the matter is that John Dean is the guy who has the Watergate cased out 6 weeks before the break-in, according to the memoirs of both Tony Ulasewicz and Jack Caulfield, two New York police detectives, decorated cops who worked as investigators for Dean and before that for Ehrlichman, both say that they were directed to case the place out. It is Dean who tells Jeb Stuart Magruder, one of the great weasels of all time, to tell Liddy to break into the Watergate, for which he uses Hunt's team.
I mean, did they do this because they wanted Nixon to fall?
Well, I think there's several things going on here at once. Dean, I believe, gets this ball rolling. He tells Magruder, Mitchell has approved this. Mitchell has never approved this, as I said earlier.
Right.
So Dean does know in advance. The real question is, what did Dean know and when does he know it? This guy is living a lie. His new book, he says it's based on 463 new tapes, but he won't release them. And he ignores those other conversations. I believe, more importantly, that he is the guy who sets the ball in motion. He recruits Liddy. He directs Liddy to write the Gemstone Plan. Dean is the one who badgers the CIA to pay for bail money for the Watergate burglars. He is the one who tells Nixon you should use the CIA, it's Mitchell's idea, to block the FBI, the so-called smoking gun maneuver, which brings Nixon down. John Dean is the Watergate weasel. He's not telling the full truth. He's not a naive young man sucked into the cover-up. He sucks Nixon into the cover-up. Why? Because John Dean wants to get into the Watergate because he's interested in the records of a call girl ring, an escort service, a whorehouse, if you will, at the Columbia Plaza that he knows the Democrats are using for assassinations with big visiting Democrats.
So that's what he wants.
That's what he wants. The agency becomes aware, and they see their opportunity to gum this thing up. So McCord and Hunt and the Cubans who work for the CIA are on a slightly different mission than the guys who are in there on behalf of John Dean.
All right, so they
and Liddy, who I think is a very decent fellow, but an intelligence amateur, is basically being set up by his CIA colleague.
All right, so they get caught. The thing unravels. 18 and a half minutes of a tape that God knows what was on, probably nothing. And Nixon, why does he quit?
Well, first of all, I think you've made a very good point here, and that is, first, I think we have to talk about how Nixon survives. Spiro Agnew is railroaded out of the line of succession. He ultimately only pleads to a minor tax issue. He told me personally, and he wrote in his book, that they moved him out. Al Haig came and threatened him. He says, you'll resign or else. Agnew writes in his book, or else what? I'll be killed in a car accident? I'll have a mysterious heart attack? Or will they use a shooter? It's at the same time the Church Committee is revealing CIA involvement in foreign
affairs. Why did they want Spiro? Because they couldn't
control him. Nixon needed Ford because he knew that Ford, as a member of the Warren Commission, had been responsible for changing the autopsy records for John Kennedy, moving the description of the wound in Kennedy's upper back to his lower neck to accommodate the single bullet theory. Nixon knew it in real time. We don't learn this until that autopsy is declassified in the 90s. And at that time, it's reported in the New York Times and Associated Press, Ford is asked why he made this egregious change, and he says the country needed clarity. Nixon had Al Haig tell Jerry Ford before he resigned on August 1st, if Nixon's going down, he's taking everybody with him. He knows what you did in the Warren Commission, Jerry. He's taking Lyndon Johnson down, the agency boys, Operation 40, the CIA Castro plots. He's going to tell it all when he's in the dock.
So he wanted a pardon set up.
And he got it from August 1st. It's interesting. General Haig, who I really believe is working for the Pentagon and makes, it will come to the 18 and a half minute gap because I think he's responsible for the 18 and a half minute gap. He also gives Nixon a number of misdirections during his fight, which can only be described as huge setbacks. He tells Nixon that Elliot Richardson will not resign in the Saturday Night Massacre, that he can fire Cox and Richardson will stick. That's not what Richardson told Haig. When the two of them quit, it's the beginning of the end for Nixon.
See, and I think when this was going on, I was a young radio reporter at the time in Detroit, Roger, that 18 and a half minute gap, it nailed Nixon because of what wasn't on it.
Right, exactly. So what transpires here is very simple, and that is when the Senate Watergate Committee learns that Alexander Butterfield, who, by the way, I'm convinced is CIA, who worked with General Haig in the military on the Bay of Pigs disaster, where both of them are working, who then is a CIA front man in Australia, has been planted inside the Nixon White House. They have the tapes. Rosemary Woods admits to a five-minute erasure. Within minutes of doing it, accidentally, she reports it to Len Garment and Fred Buzhardt, who were Nixon's lawyers, and to General Haig. Buzhardt says, don't worry, it's not on a subpoenaed tape. So they relax, but they shouldn't have, because Buzhardt is wrong.
Uh-huh.
So the tapes are in the custody of General Haig and Mr. Butterfield. By the time they get to the Senate Watergate Committee, what was 5 minutes has become 18 and a half minutes. There are two additional erasers now totaling 18 and a half minutes. Now, interestingly, at the same time, according to all the president's men, Deep Throat tells Bob Woodward there's a deliberate erasure on the tapes. You're right. It's the erasure itself, not what's on it, that brings Nixon down. Exactly. That's what causes the firestorm. Now, if you want to know what's on it, you could make something up. But if you look at Bob Haldeman's contemporaneous handwritten notes from the conversation, it appears to be housekeeping stuff, not related to Watergate.
At all.
It's a setup, and it is very effective. Haig learns that the Senate Watergate Committee is going to call Butterfield on a Monday, and they're going to confront him about the tapes, and then it's all over because the tapes are, show Nixon's certain guilt in the cover-up, not the break-in, but the cover-up. And he doesn't tell Nixon in time. He sees Nixon in the hospital, who Nixon's got pneumonia, on Saturday several times. He never tells him. So Nixon is taken by surprise on Monday when the tapes hit the fan. And
what was Haig, a Deep Throat?
Haig is a composite of Deep Throat. There is no Deep Throat. You see, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein are getting their information from the grand jury, and that's a crime. That's a felony. Lawyers cannot disclose grand jury testimony, and everybody in the room is a lawyer. So they have to cover their tail because of their illegal sourcing. They create this fiction. We know several things.
And a reporter doesn't have to tell his sources.
Well, first of all, Deep Throat is not in their original Washington Post reporter. He's never referenced his nor are any of his quotes. He's not in their initial book proposal, according to their editor, followed by the name of Obst. Ben Bradley tells Jeff Himmelman for New York Magazine that there was no Deep Throat. It's a literary device. So it's not in their initial book proposal. I think it's a fraud. It is a combination of people. Al Haig is one. Mark Felt, in my opinion, is one. But Mark Felt has already left the Bureau by the time the tapes are disclosed. He no longer has access to the information, and a number of things that Deep Throat says are incorrect. So I think Deep Throat is an amalgamation of Donald Santarelli, who has confirmed this, that he was a source for them. He's an aide to Mitchell. I think Hugh Sloan, the treasurer of the committee to elect the president, is a source. I think Haig is a source, as I said. I think there are others. John P. Sears is a source for Bernstein. Sears is a very central guy in Nixon's comeback, very crucial in the election of Ronald Reagan, very well detailed in my book. Nixon makes a terrible mistake by getting rid of the bright young conservative intellectuals he surrounds himself in 1968 and bringing in the ad men. Haldeman and Ehrlichman served the president by isolating him.
They did. That's true. That's the way they were.
Well, Nixon brought it on himself. He wanted this isolation. He was an introvert and an extrovert's business. He was a brooder. He really hated confrontation.
Roger, why did this day, this is just a little off here, but why to this day have we not tried to open up relations with Cuba?
Well, here is why. Because those who say that the Cuban embargo should be removed because it would increase business and therefore social and business contacts in Cuba don't understand that the way the system is set up, if a foreign businessman from Spain or the United States does business in Cuba, his partner is the government. You can't partner with local Cubans. It's not legal.
Right.
You give them dollars. They use it for the police state. That gets more people for the secret police, for the Castro brothers. And pesos are what trickle down to the populace. Meanwhile, they control all communications, so they think we're having race riots every other week, like in, say, Missouri. I mean, they're being shown everything bad that's happening in American society, and nobody tells them the good side. Removing the embargo won't have a trickle-down theory to the people. It will merely emblazon and fund the secret police. It's not like Eastern Europe, where you could partner with local Ukrainians.
So is Castro as bad as Batista was?
Oh, I think he's worse. He's one of the great mass murderers. I mean, when I see kids wearing a Che Guevara T-shirt, I want to punch them out. Che Guevara was a murdering thug. He was a murdering thug.
Jesse Ventura thinks Castro's a great hero.
Yeah, well, Jesse's wrong about this. Castro kissed Jesse's ass. I love Jesse, but he's wrong about this. Castro is up there with Hitler and Stalin as a mass murderer.
Roger.
My own wife is of Cuban-American descent. Her father was a Cuban diplomat who lost everything.
We're going to come back and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.